Let's find a conversation to your soul. Let's conversation to your soul and the American Prestige listeners, it's Derek. I am joined today, I'm very grateful to be joined by Omar Zaza. He is Assistant Professor of Arab Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University, and he is the author of the book we'll be talking about today, Terms of Servitude, Zionism, Silicon Valley, and Digital Settler Colonialism. That's a mouthful. In the Palestinian Liberation Struggle. Omar, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Congratulations on the book, certainly very timely, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that. I know the genesis of this book predates the ongoing genocide in Gaza, so talk a little bit, and we'll talk about the process of writing it while that was going on, but talk a little bit about what prompted you to write this book. I know you talk about the Sheikh Jarrah evictions and that incident is sort of, bringing some awareness of the what digital media can do both for and against the Palestinians. But what were some of the things that kind of influenced you in this topic?
Yeah. So, you know, as I've been noting, I really wrote this book, and I feel like it's at least the product of two kind of, in some ways, opposed moments. And the first is precisely as you say, I began thinking about a project like this shortly after the beginnings of the Sheikh Jarrah uprisings, which I'm sure your listeners are familiar with this, but just in case, very quickly, around 2021, you start to have activism and demonstrations around the looming expulsions of Palestinians from the occupied East Jerusalem neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah. And this follows on the heel of the George Floyd uprisings in 2020, which, you know, also had prompted this kind of broader cultural and global reckoning with questions of white supremacy, structural oppression, that I think really paved the way for kind of broader reckonings with other paradigms of oppression to be confronted in sort of novel forms from what we'd seen previously. And so I think with the Sheikh Jarrah uprisings, the unity intifada that, you know, grew out of them shortly thereafter, that kind of asserted that we as Palestinians, no matter where we are, whether in the diaspora, you know, whether in the homeland, are all one people. All of that, I think, was in many ways kind of part and parcel of broader reckonings with oppression that were interfacing with new and emergent forms of media. But, you know, what I felt during that time, you know, shortly after the beginnings of the Sheikh Jarrah demonstrations, which had their own kind of recorded patterns of suppression, which I'll talk about in just a second. But, you know, first I want to kind of note that in that time, even as, you know, activists were dealing with and documenting very intense forms of repression, including, you know, as we may forget, given the context now, you know, another bombing campaign within the Gaza Strip by Israel, there was still this sense that what was happening was a real narrative shift. And you were seeing media being used in these savvy ways by Palestinian activists, which was relatively novel, right? This very intentional use of both emergent digital media and legacy media, playing them off of one another in very sophisticated ways, and in a way that was really having a lot of concessions in terms of the broader cultural reckonings and conversations around the issue of Palestine, and redefining in real time for the broader public, I should say, the question of Palestine from being something that hews more closely to kind of traditional liberal, you know, narratives about coexistence or this kind of intransigence, to an actual ongoing system of dispossession and violence. So I was really responding, to that moment and kind of the underlying sense that even as there's a lot of oppression happening, things are about to change and the change is inevitable, right? Well, I'll say something else that emerged from that moment, and then I'll get to the kind of second phase that this book responds to, was that you start to really have bigger legacy media reporting on the censorship practices of social media companies. So companies, for example, you know, that are owned by Meta, Facebook and Instagram, what at the time was Twitter is now X. You start to see, you know, along the lines of the Shekshorah protests and the kind of subsequent forms of resistance, mass censorship, right? So mass censorship about posts about Shekshorah, mass censorship about posts about incursions into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, even censorship around posts about the bombings of Gaza, right? People having their accounts suspended, blocked, you know, their posts deleted, giving very unsatisfactory answers. And this happened at such a scale that legacy media outlets were forced to actually report on it. And, you know, you start getting narratives that now are very familiar, but at the time it was relatively novel that you'd been able to get these companies to make these kinds of concessions. And they said, okay, we recognize there's been overreach, but it's the result of a glitch. So you get variations of that kind of narrative. I think fast forward several years up to this point in time, this is all kind of par for the course and we're sort of used to these things. But at that time, again, you have for the first time an acknowledgement, you know, by the largest kind of cultural centers of dissemination of information, basically documenting, archiving that there is very much a Palestine exception to the usage of social media. And so at that moment, all of these things, you know, kind of stuck out to me. And I thought, you know, kind of in the same way that we're starting to have other studies and reportings about how big tech facilitates particular patterns of racial dispossession and oppression in spite of its own propaganda of being kind of this counter-hegemonic force, this new democratizing force, I felt that what we're seeing with the mass censorship of Palestinians and posts about Palestine was its own form of a kind of a racial and colonial exception of the rights of a particular people and their struggle. That, you know, a form of oppression that big tech was not only not ameliorating, but directly facilitating. And so that kind of got me to think about a project that would eventually become Terms of Servitude. But as I started working on that project and really based it on several different examples, you know, pieces that I had written for outlets like Al Jazeera, the first one was called Digital Apartheid, and this was in 2021 as well. I was talking about these forms of tech repression as digital apartheid. I ended up replacing that paradigm with digital settler colonialism, which we could talk about in just a second. But I conceived the project, you know, based on these articles. I pitch it to a publisher. And then after the book is accepted by the Censored Press and Severed Stories Press, as I'm working, about a year into it, the latest genocide begins. And in that moment, I talk about this in one of the earlier chapters, Refusing the Language of Silence. I basically had a period where I found myself unable to complete it, just because what all of us were confronting in terms of the horrors of real-time genocide, you know, not the first genocide that is launched by the Zionist Project, but I think in many ways the most insidious and one in which all other instances of mass extermination and violence kind of build upon themselves to realize what we're seeing now, right? I kind of found myself initially unable to keep writing. And so I paused it briefly, not sure when I would be able to come back to it. But then, you know, eventually, as I also write about in the book, I think realizing very unfortunately that there wasn't going to be a period where a larger power, right? Some larger so-called democratic power was going to step in and kind of stop this slaughter. You realize that this is going on for the long haul. And as a result, everybody needs to use whatever platforms they have at their disposal, do whatever they can, you know, to raise their voice against what is happening. And so I realized that Terms of Servitude was one such platform that I had. And so I needed to finish this book, you know, even as it felt wildly discordant at times, to be shifting registers between this, I recognize now, perhaps overly idealistic idea that if there's just enough information, things will change. But at the same time, also working with that necessity that we need to keep raising our voices. And so that really led me to kind of push this book through to its conclusion. There are definitely things that I look back on and I can see how it's the product of at least two different moments. I do think that I am a little bit, in some ways, less idealistic and in some ways more than when I started the project. But in a nutshell, that's kind of the broader context for working on this. And I'm happy to kind of unpack more aspects of that broader trajectory.
Well, so I actually wanted to go into some deeper background, but I think maybe since you already brought it up, this might be a good place to talk about why you made the shift from calling it digital apartheid to digital settler colonialism, and kind of give people the context for what those terms, as you conceive of them, mean, and why one is preferable to the other.
Certainly. So I will say that I don't think that digital apartheid is inaccurate per se, but I do feel that it is incomplete. And what I mean by that is that certainly you have apartheid, you know, as an integral component of the Zionist project, but apartheid in and of itself is one technology within a broader process of settler colonial violence and dispossession. And so Zionism ultimately is about the seizure and transformation of the Palestinian homeland and the elimination and expulsion of the indigenous peoples, the Palestinians. So apartheid as a process, as a structure, certainly enables that broader trajectory, but, you know, it is in and of itself part of a broader system of violence, which is settler colonialism. And so in the same way that this transpires physically, I realize that there is also a digital analog, right? And so obviously Zionism and the broader interests that converge with Zionism, right, like U.S. big tech, do have a vested interest in, as much as they can, kind of isolating and eliminating Palestinians from the digital sphere. But that desire and that modus operandi, as it were, emerges from a broader settler colonial imperative, which is part of the, ultimately, it is about the complete elimination of the Palestinian presence, right? Physically, culturally, and now digitally, as the digital emerges as an offshoot of the broader cultural apparatus.
So I want to take a step back and talk about sort of the early days of the internet and even pre-internet. I mean, you do talk about Edward Said, who's somebody I don't think we talk enough about on this program. So this gives me an opportunity to bring him into a conversation. But sort of, you know, his critique of the media, pre-internet media landscape, and the ways that Palestinian voices were excluded completely from discussions of Palestine. So maybe we could put this in the bigger context of what this is, what this discourse has been like throughout, and then sort of talk about the early days of the internet when you do get the emergence of outlets that cover the Palestinian story, but you also get the emergence of places like Canary, things like Canary Mission, Campus Watch, that are basically there to police speech and put at risk anybody who is deemed to be talking about Israel in unfavorable terms. So let's start with the bigger context and then kind of move into early internet days.
Yeah, great question. So certainly, you know, and I mentioned this throughout the book, the thought and the criticism of Edward Said has been very pivotal to this project. But one essay of his that I draw on is the 1984 piece, Permission to Narrate. And in that work, Said makes the argument that Palestinians have been denied what he calls permission to narrate. And what he means by that is that when you have a particular political context, you know, in this case, looking at the Palestinian struggle, it's not enough just to have information. You also need narratives, right? Because narrative is what gives coherence to pieces of information or to the facts, right? As he terms it in the essay. And so what Said argues is that, you know, in the case of Palestine, what has happened is that, you know, although there is a lot of information that is analyzed, that is presented within the legacy media or the corporate media, Palestinians themselves are routinely you know, have their voices omitted, they're erased, they're silenced. And this silencing, this delegitimization, this cultural delegitimization, right, that is routinely practiced by the legacy media, in turn kind of facilitates this other related process of delegitimization, which is the normalization of narratives that really contradict what the actual facts are. So, for example, this notion of Israel as this unimpeachable bastion of democracy that always acts in the greater interests of, you know, the so-called democratic project that can do no wrong, that is simply besieged, you know, by these armies of fanatical anti-Semitic terrorists, right? The erasure of Palestinians in turn helps to facilitate the cultural maintenance and propagation of these propagandistic narratives. And of course, this is also related to what Herman and Chomsky have referred to as manufacturing consent, right? These analyses really build upon one another in kind of illustrating a broader political function to the legacy media. But so, you know, Said's essay is one of the most pivotal, I think, in understanding how legacy media has for decades really acted as a delegitimizing force in relationship to the Palestinian struggle. And so, you know, Palestinians have often had to work against a very hostile media environment and be very savvy in terms of how they repurposed or how they redirected the machinations of legacy media under the broader imprimatur of U.S. imperialism. So you have this context in which media, you know, in and of itself works to manufacture consent, partly through the erasure of the Palestinian perspective, and not to say as well, you know, the demonization of, you know, Palestinian activism and resistance rightful, right, to this ongoing process of dispossession. And then you start to have the emergence of the internet, right? And especially, you know, in its early days, there are these narratives that the internet represents, you know, kind of a new counter-hegemonic force, right? It's an emergent form of media, and it can have a democratizing potential that will counter, you know, in many ways, the kind of limited foci of the legacy media, of the corporate media. And, you know, Palestinians certainly do take advantage of it, right? I talk in the book about this, how particularly during the time of the Second Intifada in the early 2000s, you also start to have the emergence of a vibrant, you know, online Palestinian identity. And part of this is precisely that the internet, you know, emerging forms at the time, you know, from email to eventually what becomes blogging, very concretely allow people to bypass kind of the material constrictions of military occupation, you know, including the curfews and the checkpoints that are imposed during the Intifada. But there is also this element of the fact that these new forms of media allow people to respond increasingly in real time to the strategic misrepresentations of corporate media, right? And so, you know, you have listservs growing, you have, you know, journalists who are able to interface with, you know, Palestinian activists or journalists themselves who are starting to continue to issue corrections. So there is this way in which the internet increasingly acts as a corrective to the mainstream Western media's facilitation of Zionist settler colonialism. But, you know, as your question, I think, astutely notes, you also have, you know, this kind of double-sided quality to the internet. The ability of the internet to be weaponized, to be gained also for the interests of the Zionist project. And that's what we start to see really with the emergence of sites like Canary Mission, right, which I talk about, you know, kind of realizing how I was one of the earlier batches of organizers who had been added to that site when it came out around 2015. You know, then you have the emergence of newer sites kind of in that mold, like stopantisemitism.org. And this kind of gets me to what I think is perhaps a second or at least a sub-aspect of digital settler colonialism, which is precisely how these emergent technologies not only enable settler colonialism through the willful cooperation of the big tech industry, but also just in the ways that these spaces can be weaponized in and of themselves through Zionism, but also how the, I guess I would say, very egregious and outlandish forms of targeting, doxing, and harassment can really be allowed to transpire without much thought as to how outrageous it really is. I mean, the fact that you've had groups of people just have it be normal that they can be blacklisted and doxxed, you know, for organizing for Palestine, for activism for Palestine, and have that happen for many years, really without causing that much of a stir outside of, you know, perhaps a dedicated slew of independent media and activist organizations, right? Of course, I will definitely say that the percentage of concern has increased, especially post-October 7th. But for many years, this kind of continued relatively unabated, right? And I do think, you know, as your question helps set up, it's precisely because of the type of sustained demonization and delegitimization that we've seen practiced through cultural forces like the legacy media that in turn allowed for these novel forms of weaponization of online and digital media to not only to thrive, but to thrive with relative impunity, right? I think now that we're seeing so much targeting to the extent that even people who may have not been as involved with the Palestinian struggle prior to the latest genocide are now facing some forms of repression that were previously, you know, reserved for people who did these forms of organizing more regularly. Even such, I think what we're dealing with is a very sustained form or series of forms of harassment that have been allowed to thrive relatively unchecked. And I'd say that's also the result of different forms of media delegitimization working hand in hand with one another.
So let's delve a little bit into that. And the social media, I mean, I do want to get into sort of where these companies have now started to take a direct role in targeting and killing people. But let's start with the social media aspect of this. The talk, you know, when social media emerged, and even still in some instances, you get a lot of talk about how this is the great leveler. This is the thing that allows people to organize, to get around censorship, to get around government blocks. And it never quite seems to work out that way. And so when we talk about it in the case of the Palestinians, was there a moment where this technology actually was sort of open to that space and then the tech companies came in and shut it down? Or as you've observed this, has it always been kind of policed in this way by companies like Meta and, you know, Twitter, X, you know, whatever?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think to kind of put it in a nutshell, and then I'll expand on this a little bit, the real story of social media and Palestinians is a story of a group of people resisting colonization who were able to use an emergent platform in such a savvy way as to really turn the old propaganda narratives about their cause on its head and to do it in a way that really captured hearts and minds and continues to do so. And it's also a story of how the companies that run these platforms started to realize that this was the case and began to clamp down more and more. I think, to me, that's the most accurate way to put it, because I don't think we can really deny that social media makes it possible to spread more information in real time, right? And that's what Palestinians did. In precisely the same way that they would use the embattled site of legacy media, right, to advance their narrative, in spite of the fact that you're contending with such a hostile space, even when you do that, social media becomes an emergent form of media that also needs to be met and utilized head on as part and parcel of the broader Palestinian struggle, which includes consciousness raising, right? That said, I think one good example of how this played out would be on the site that we now call X. You know, it was Twitter at the time. I talked to Palestinians in Gaza, including Asim al-Nabi of the Gaza municipality, Yusuf al-Jamal, and they told me how Palestinians in Gaza for many years took to Twitter, and this was intentionally Twitter, because there was already this awareness that Facebook, you know, what we now refer to as Meta, was a hostile space. And I'll get into the kind of genealogy of that in a second, because I think that that's also important. But they sort of realized that, you know, Facebook in and of itself would not be the ideal platform. But Twitter, which, you know, I think we've seen used to break crucial information regarding other struggles over the years, they realized that this could be a good platform in order to spread awareness about, you know, bombing campaigns in the Gaza Strip, the realities of the siege, basically all of the things that legacy media tended to omit. And so, you know, through these interviews, people revealed to me how they applied a very sophisticated and savvy understanding of narrative to these digital platforms to increasingly raise public consciousness about bombing campaigns in the Gaza Strip by Israel, right? To spread awareness about, you know, the horrific situation of Gaza under the occupation, under the siege, you know, not to mention military assault. And, you know, they had analytics like, you know, how much does it take for a post to go viral, you know, at the time? What do we need to be posting in order to make sure there's maximal spread? And I say this not to suggest that there's something artificial about the information, but precisely to show just how dedicated and savvy people can be against all odds, because, you know, they're working against what was almost a total media blackout of reporting on Gaza. And they realized this is how we can do it with these tools, you know, that are supposedly democratic, that are supposedly counter-hegemonic, you know, let's put that to the test. And so when I talked to, you know, when I interviewed Palestinians in Gaza about this, what some of them said was that even as there is this sense, of course, you know, the genocide continues, it's horrific, but there is this real also sense of we were able to affect a narrative change, and we, you know, the grassroots did this, right, in a lot of ways, precisely because we broke information that now can't be retracted, right? Of course, posts can be deleted, you know, accounts can be banned, but the information, you know, the awareness, I should say, that people gain, that's irreversible. And so, you know, even as I was talking to people in the midst of an unfathomable genocide, what, you know, this is again Asim al-Nabi of the Gaza municipality, what he said, in many ways, you know, in terms of the narrative, we've won. And, you know, that was striking even to me, because again, I think maybe I had internalized some of the kind of sense of defeatism perhaps that can sometimes come when you're dealing with such unfathomable odds, or I should say speaking about it, because I'm not in the middle of Gaza myself. But I feel that I had perhaps internalized more defeatism than, you know, the people that I was interviewing. And so that's one thing Asim told me, you know, no, we've won. And actually, we need to thank every person in Gaza who's ever taken out their phone, because what we're seeing now in terms of the broader shift in consciousness, that was something that we brought about directly through steady and sustained organizing and activism and applying narrative activism through these digital technologies. Now, of course, we've seen what X has become, right? And even in 2021, 2022, you saw increasing censorship of that platform. And I talked to others in the book who were using Twitter at that time, because that was the most real-time savvy app, I would say, right? And so they realized, like, even news couldn't move that fast, so we had to post about just basic things. You know, what was bombed most recently? Where, you know, who do we need to check on? We would be posting all of that to Twitter, and those things were getting increasingly banned and censored. So it is very much a story about how companies became savvy, increasingly more savvy to how their platforms are being used for purposes they weren't supposed to be used for, right? To counter settler colonialism and military occupation, and increasingly came to clamp down. And, you know, I mentioned Meta. I think Meta is interesting because it's the most unapologetic and obvious about this, right? If you see the ways that it moves, the way it's normalized, the criticism, the banning, excuse me, of the criticism of Zionism on its platform, which I think is also having implications in terms of Twitch.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to talk about Meta as sort of a special case, because it's such a good example of the weaponization of, you know, sort of the to, you know, what your title is playing on, the terms of service or the community standards, or what you, you know, the title of your book kind of is a play on terms of service and, you know, this weaponization of these things to shut down voices that they basically don't want on the platform. So yeah, let's get into Meta for a second. And also they will come back when we talk about AI, certainly as well, but let's talk about Meta for a second.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, Meta, you know, as I had mentioned, is basically the most upfront about this. Let's put it that way. I think there can be a little bit more murkiness about this, sometimes regarding other platforms, but Meta is basically pretty explicit and direct about the fact that it censors in this way, and in this way, in terms of the restrictions of posts by Palestinians or about Palestine, and that it's really normalized the censorship of those posts, right? In the mid-2010s, say, I believe about 2015, you know, you have this Facebook delegation, you know, this Facebook at the time. So the company sends some representatives to Israel to discuss what was billed as the use of its platform to incite terrorism, right? So the delegation is a so-called counterterrorism venue, right? And, you know, really it's around that time that you start to see increasing outcry by digital rights organizations talking about how not only Facebook was standardizing its censorship, you know, which was increasingly lopsided against Palestinians, right? But that you're also seeing Palestinians jailed for incitement on social media. Around this time, you see the appointment of Emmy Palmer, you know, who had formerly helped start the cyber unit, you know, which really streamlined the process of criminalizing Palestinians for social media. You see the appointment of Palmer to Facebook's oversight board, which also had raised outcry by organizations, activist organizations. And so you see all of these moves, not just these moderation moves, which are escalating, but you also see these policy moves that really seem to solidify Facebook's dedication to Israel first and foremost. You know, and in 2016, you have the appointment of Jordana Cutler to the position of now it's Meta's head of Israel and the Jewish diaspora, right? And The Intercept has done really good reporting on Cutler and her role, not only in moderation, you know, which includes, people have argued, you know, direct censorship of posts by organizations like Students for Justice in Palestine, but even other Meta policy heads for other countries, you know, have gone on the record and really complained about how much leeway seems to be given to Israel. You know, they'd say, if I'd said half of the things that Cutler said about what I'm here to do, you know, to advance the interests of a foreign government, I mean, this would not be allowed to fly. And yet we seem to have an official who can, you know, proudly talk about, you know, having ties to the Israeli government and doing Israel's bidding. And that doesn't have any kind of consequence. It's very much normalized within the platform. So I do think Meta is really important as a case study of the normalization of what I'm referring to as digital settler colonialism, basically all of the ways that these big tech companies can streamline the Israeli colonial process through the digital erasure of Palestine and Palestinians. But I think that there's a danger with that too, not just in terms of Meta's own actions, but how when you see a successful company doing something, it normalizes it for all of the other companies. So Meta doing this so unabashedly, so proudly, I think gives license for other big tech companies, first and foremost concerned with their success, to do the same.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp. As seasons change and days grow darker sooner, it can be a tough time for many. That's why it's important to stay connected. It's time to reach out and check in with those you care about and to remind ourselves that we're not alone. This November, BetterHelp is encouraging everyone to check in on friends, reconnect with loved ones, and let them know that you're there. Just as it can take a little courage to send that message or grab coffee with someone you haven't seen in a while, reaching out for therapy can feel difficult too, but it's worth it. And it almost always leaves people wondering, why didn't I do this sooner? With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is one of the largest online therapy platforms, having served over 5 million people globally. And BetterHelp has an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. This month, don't wait to reach out. Whether you're checking in on a friend or reaching out to a therapist yourself, BetterHelp makes it easier to take that first step. Our listeners get 10% off their first month at BetterHelp.com/TheNation. That's BetterHelp.com/TheNation. This holiday season, comfort means slowing down and finding calm amid the chaos. Create your natural oasis by prioritizing rest, comfort, and connection with Avocado Green Mattress. As the holidays fill up with gatherings and to-do lists, Avocado mattresses and home essentials provide the foundation for deeper rest, calmer mornings, and a healthier daily routine. Every product is thoughtfully made with the planet in mind, so you can feel good about the comfort and quality you bring into your home. Avocado is better for you and better for the planet. And to make your purchase more accessible, you'll have easy financing options with Affirm. Prioritize rest and recharge with Avocado's organic comfort. Head to avocadogreenmattress.com today to create your natural oasis and save big during their holiday sale. Avocado, dream of better.
So this leads sort of naturally, I think, into a bigger discussion about the linkages between the Israeli security state, and this will take us into discussions about the use of AI and the other technologies that are being used to kill people now in Gaza. But the link between the Israeli security state and these tech companies, but in all sorts of ways. I mean, there's connections that the sort of, you know, we talk to these companies regularly or we interact with them regularly, but there's also people going from, you know, the IDF's unit 8200, the sort of electronic warfare unit, getting jobs in, you know, high level jobs in companies like Meta and other Silicon Valley firms. Can you sort of talk about that relationship between the IDF or the Israeli security state and these tech companies?
Yeah, definitely. I think it's at this point, it's pretty straightforward that there is a revolving door between, you know, something like between, for example, Unit 8200, which is this, you know, Israeli cyber warfare, cybersecurity division, right? And the largest big tech companies globally, right? I mean, the number of veterans of that unit that are appointed to these companies is pretty high. And it's basically an entrenched feature of the big tech industry at this point in time. You also have, you know, to return to Meta, in terms of its top brass, you know, you have Israeli individuals on the board. You have people, you know, like Cutler with direct ties to the government who are enforcing, a lot of moderation policies and avowedly doing so under the, you know, explicit admission, right, of working for the best interests of the Israeli state. And then you have things like, I believe it was Paul Begar who had broken the story about how WhatsApp metadata was being provided by Meta as part of the targeted kill list, Where's Daddy, which was one of the AI targeting programs that enables the occupation forces to track people targeted for assassination, even when they're at home, and, you know, to target them accordingly. So you have this revolving door of officials. You have these companies willingly providing data. You have the use of AI to create these kill lists and companies that are willingly facilitating this process. I didn't talk about this at the book because the story hadn't broken then. But one of the things I also reported later for Electronic Intifada was that Dell hardware is being used to power a lot of these, you know, AI programs as well. So it's not a question of how are these companies, you know, directly implicated in the genocide. It's, I think at this point, a better question is how are they not, right? So there's definitely a lengthy track record that we could go through, But one of the things I also wanted to do in the book, and this is kind of how I try to repurpose the term digital settler colonialism, is not just to use it to refer to how digital technologies enable colonial processes, but also to think about how this particular enabling is facilitated through a collaboration between the U.S., you know, big tech industry and the Israeli colonial project, right? Obviously, there's a lot of entrenched interest in this. There are bottom lines that are being pursued, but nothing about this is inevitable, right? And everything, every step of the way, is the result of concrete choices that have been made by these companies to continue to facilitate this process of violence, dispossession, and now genocide.
So I want to talk a little bit about the use of social media, which is coming to the U.S. now, but has been the case in Israel for some time. I mean, I don't want to say it's just coming to the U.S. now. That's the wrong way to phrase it. But the Trump administration is certainly making greater use of social media for identifying people who are saying things that they don't like and need to be dealt with. Mahmoud Khalil, for example, or really anyone in the U.S. on a semi-precarious basis, a student visa or anything else that the government could revoke and kick them out, or having their social media scrubbed. We're hearing about, looking at people's phones when they try to come into the country and sort of looking at their posts and restricting access to the United States on this basis. And one of the things that you talk about in the book is, like, this is not a subject that is coming out of the blue. People have written about governments using social media to track and identify dissidents or, you know, people that they would like to have a conversation with. But there is a huge blind spot when it comes to Israel, or specifically when it comes to the Palestinian discourse. As you note in the book, there's been writing about, you know, the way the Russian government does this kind of stuff, or the way, you know, that other governments sort of use social media as a tool of repression. But there's really not a lot that anybody's willing to say about the way Israel has done it, or now the way the U.S. is doing it increasingly with respect to the Palestinian cause. Can you talk a little bit about that phenomenon?
Yeah. And that's one of the things I had really wanted to do with Terms of Servitude, was to basically produce a work of tech criticism that put the Palestinian struggle into the broader conversation of tech criticism, you know, as it were. Precisely because, as you note, what I'd started to see is that at times there really was an omission or a gap. Right, people would be writing about things such as the ways that tech can be used to fortify political oppression, and, you know, Palestine, which it seems like in many ways, you know, such a clear example of that, was not discussed. So I was thinking, for example, of, you know, Charlton Gillespie's book Custodians of the Internet, which I think is a very important study of content moderation. But that work, and I think a lot of, you know, other traditions of tech criticism, you know, we tend to see critiques of Russia, or, you know, we'll see critiques of China, right? These places that happen to be the US's enemy in terms of, you know, an imperial kind of rivalry, right? Oftentimes, tech criticism, I found, would hew, you know, along kind of these lines, where the culprits that could be named were also the ones that, you know, imperialism had already rendered very nicely to be, you know, a villain, you know. And yet, when you have something like the Zionist project, like the suppression of Palestinians, which again, when you look back over the history of Meta, which we discussed, right, in relationship to how it's just so clearly advanced a project of both censoring Palestinians and working in direct consort with the Israeli government to help it facilitate its own project of criminalizing Palestinians for social media use, right? Is also a very direct example of suppression of political rights, right? Of freedom of speech, and that tech companies are willingly facilitating, yet we don't see a lot of discussion of that. And to me, I mean, we do, but, you know, not as much as there could be. And to me, it really seemed like what happens now, where you have a political moment like this, where an administration like the Trump administration can so egregiously streamline things like targeting people for their postings about Palestine on social media, using that as a rationale for, you know, kidnapping, disappearing, for deportation. That political reality is enabled by those other silences, right? Precisely because we've had a situation where for so long it was routine, it was normalized to apply a double standard when it came to Palestine and to the rights of activists and organizers for Palestine. That double standard, you know, becomes entrenched in the broader cultural mainstream, right? And so I would say that in part what we're experiencing now, right, where it's become so normalized to have this type of broader political censorship and surveillance, is precisely because we've had so much silence and such a kind of taking for granted that it's fine for, you know, people who support Palestine to have their rights suspended in this way. And of course, you know, this is never the reason you should support a cause first and foremost, but, you know, this is exactly what people in the movement have said for years. If you allow this to happen, you know, this is not going to stay limited to Palestine. This is going to bleed out. And what we're experiencing right now is precisely that bleeding out.
So I think as we come to an end here, and folks should pick up the book, and it really does put all of this stuff into a great context for people who are concerned about this issue. But what should people be aware of? I mean, I assume most of the people who listen to this show are probably on social media. Many of them may wish they were not on social media, like me. Wish they could quit it, but probably they interact with these companies on a regular basis. And you know, what can people kind of look out for, be aware of, or even try to do to help rectify what seems like an increasingly dire situation where, you know, this is just being with the narrative, the more the narrative seems to break through, the harder the boot comes down to sort of try and snuff it out. So what are some things that just, you know, people can be aware of or try to do to rectify that?
Yeah, I think one thing is to understand ultimately that it's not the platforms that are at issue here in terms of advancing change, right? It's really always been the creativity and the determination of Palestinians to secure their own freedom first and foremost that led to the narrative shifts that we're experiencing today. The fact that social media facilitated those shifts, right? It was kind of a conduit for that, is, to a certain extent, it's a variable. I think that there is a lot of despondency that can emerge from seeing just how complicit these companies are and just how willing they are to ultimately suppress the rights of Palestinians and increasingly all of those who support their cause. But one thing we can take away is that, you know, from this, is that liberation isn't something that's going to come from a platform, right? At the end of the day, there's going to be a new platform tomorrow, most likely, right? Maybe all of the platforms I've written about will be outdated. But what isn't going to change is the need to continue to support freedom and liberation. And there are many avenues from which we can do that, even as these companies become increasingly censorious, right? We have other ways of raising our voice, of amplifying the struggle, and of supporting Palestinian freedom, no matter the cost. So I would just say, you know, don't lose hope, don't despair, and understand that there's always going to be more to life than social media. And the fact that they're cracking down, I think, just shows how out of touch they are with the political urgencies of the current moment. But there's always something we can do despite that.
And I think, I mean, to just add to that, I think that the hopeful thing to me here is that despite the heavy hand, despite the efforts to shut down Palestinian voices, to shut down even pro-Palestinian voices, wherever they're coming from, the message is still breaking through. Like, public opinion is shifting. There has been a measurable effect. We haven't seen it at the level of policy, because I could go into a whole host of reasons why we haven't seen it as policy yet. But we do see, I think, people's minds being changed regardless. And that, you know, maybe that's part of this story that we should note too.
Exactly. Yeah. And again, you know, I think it's as Palestinians themselves told me, the consciousness is irreversible. And so I think that we can definitely take hope from that and understand that, you know, any post can be deleted, any account can be banned, but that newfound understanding and the realization of the necessity to act because of this new knowledge, I think that that's something that really can't and won't be taken away. And so I think we just need to keep that in mind and move forward with that and continue trying to make change however we can from wherever we are. And that's ultimately, you know, what the spirit of the book was intended to reflect.
So on that note, Omar Zaza, again, the book is Terms of Servitude, Zionism, Silicon Valley, and Digital Settler Colonialism in the Palestinian Liberation Struggle. We'll have a link to buy it in the show description. Please go check it out. Thank you so much, Omar, for coming on the program.
Thank you so much for having me.